Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, and today it is my pleasure to have back as a return guest, Allison Lefkowitz. Allison is a licensed marriage and family therapist based in New York City. She received her master's degree in marriage and family therapy from Hofstra University in Long Island, New York. She also received her BA in theater arts from California State University, Northridge. Allison is licensed in New York, Michigan, and Florida, and currently sees clients virtually. In her private practice, Allison specializes in helping highly sensitive people heal from and manage life's difficulties while honoring their sensitive souls and nervous systems. She also has a special interest in assisting clients to recover from childhood and narcissistic abuse. She is the author of the Highly Sensitive Person's Toolkit, which was published in 2020 in the U.S. and internationally. Allison, welcome back to the Teaching Journeys podcast. I have been looking forward to our conversation for some time now.
Oh, thank you, Dave. I've been looking forward to coming back. So thanks for having me again.
Yes. And for those in my audience who may not remember or may not have listened to this previous episode, I had Allison, along with another therapist, a good friend of both of ours, who is based in the Mohawk Valley in central New York, in the Utica, New York area, Suzanne Chabot. And we talked about trauma bonds, and it was just a great episode. It's just a lot of great information. And, you know, I got a lot of great comments about the episode from different people. So, and I talked to Allison about specifically having a podcast around her work with highly sensitive people, her book, what she's discovered as a therapist, and how best to hold space as therapists, as coaches for highly sensitive people. So,
definitely.
So we got a lot of territory to cover. So I guess unless you have any questions for me, we'll get right down to it.
I'm good. Only just a shout out, Suzanne. Hello, Suzanne. Hopefully we'll be back on the podcast again together. But she's the one that introduced us. So just wanted to give her a big thank you again.
Yeah. You guys have an open invitation to come on anytime. If you have an episode idea that the two of you want to run, we'll get right into it. We'll have you back. So anyway, my first question for you is tell our audience about the experiences that have shaped your life path and your life passions today.
Sure. And I might be referencing my notes that are in front of me, so my eyes are moving around just to let you know. But this was a great question. It's a big question. And I think the easiest way I can sum it up as a highly sensitive person. Also, I have other forms of neurodivergence. I won't divulge all the letters that also accompany described traits about me, but I have a lot of intersections as well, as I've discovered. And also during the really confusing time and chaotic time we're living in, I've also been able to sit with myself more, but I've always been a really observant person. I've always been super fascinated with the human condition, about how people operate and how they work. I think that's what led me to theater at first, is that I'm sort of curious about people. And when you really study people and do that deeper study around plays and playwrights, you really get into people's psyche. So I think I started there, and also my family history. My father is a child of Holocaust survivors. Both my grandparents were survivors. My grandmother was in Auschwitz. I talk about in my book a little bit. And so many children of Holocaust survivors, you grow up with these trauma stories. And then also you'll see certain behaviors, because trauma, as I talk to my clients, it can be interesting how it shows up, and it shows up different for everyone. And there were certain things within my father, within things I noticed within my parents' marriage, within our extended family, and a lot of dynamics didn't make sense. And then also my mother's side also, I think, has a lot of undiagnosed neurodivergence, also has a lot of intergenerational trauma, different from the Holocaust, obviously, but also a lot of different personalities and behaviors and just stuff that didn't make sense. I was listening to a podcast this morning with Bethany Frankel. You know who Bethany Frankel is? She's kind of like a polarized, she's like a reality star. She's a lot in the news, a lot of reality stuff. She's on Real Housewives. She was doing an interview talking about her childhood trauma. And she was talking about part of how she coped was through her own mind and through her own thinking and her analyzing. It was almost like her friend, like her companion, her own interior space. And though I don't think Bethany herself is highly sensitive, that particular piece about having your own mind, your own interior space is almost like a friend or a companion to help explain the world and the people and the confusing things that you're living in. And so that plus my life experience is what led me to start this path of discovery, of having this deep inner life, having these confusing adults around me, not having names for it, and wanting to figure it out, because that's still how I cope these days, being able to at least be able to name and categorize things, even if it is, okay, that doesn't make sense. That goes in the that doesn't make sense column. So yeah, let me pause there. I just said a lot to you.
You did. And you mentioned your grandparents being Holocaust survivors. And, mm-hmm. The media, I go to generational trauma. And I'm sure, I would imagine for HSPs, generational trauma might become more heightened. They might be more sensitized to that. Is that the case, or am I off base with that?
No, you're not. Unfortunately, and this is one of the more difficult parts of being highly sensitive, because we take in a lot more sensory information.
Yes.
Then, 80% of the population, if we go through something traumatic, we will unfortunately absorb more of that traumatic experience. And so we are more affected by trauma. And especially within our development, when our brains and ourselves are growing and developing in our sense of self. Absolutely.
I agree. Because one of the things I've understood about highly sensitive people, or HSPs, mm-hmm. is kind of the acronym for it, is that.
Yeah.
They take in not only their own inner energy in terms of dealing mm-hmm. with their own trauma and mm-hmm. dealing with trying to find their place in the world as an HSP, but but they're taking on the energy of other people's traumas. And I imagine mm-hmm. that has got to be overwhelming for at
yes,
times.
Yes. And that part of the acronym you're talking about is DOES, D-O-E-S, depth of processing, overstimulation, and the E stands for empathy. Yeah. And yes, absolutely. When we have a traumatic experience, especially if it's not just that, someone else, yes, we will absorb more of that. Or I find sometimes we have what's called like lopsided empathy or disproportionate empathy, where we might have more for other people and less for ourselves, even if you and someone went through the exact same experience.
Yeah. So I imagine one of the things you probably emphasize with HSPs, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, it's mm-hmm. probably a lot of self-care, trying to find mm-hmm. some grounding techniques, maybe inner light mm-hmm. meditations, walks out in nature, just so mm-hmm. they can become grounded, more yes. balanced, and manage their energy appropriately and learn to set mm-hmm. boundaries and manage the energy of others.
Yes, yes. You're kind of naming some of the sensitive core skills that I talk about in the beginning of the book, and absolutely. And it's also for HSPs, it's really an individualized personal set of what are our own personal boundaries, our own preferences, our own boundaries. So that's what I do a lot with people too. Because also HSPs, we have similarities, but we're also different. And so sort of figuring out what those are. Yeah.
So let's get into the therapy side of it. What do therapists get right about working with HSPs? What do they get wrong about working with HSPs?
I love this question so much because it's something I run into. I talk about it in the intro to my book. And I also just had a personal experience with a mental health professional that I have worked with for many years. We handled it beautifully, repaired it beautifully. So no knock on him, but yes, it's something we deal with. We were talking before we started the podcast, and I thought it might be helpful to actually just read the introduction of my book to kind of frame what this issue is and how often this comes up and how therapists really get it wrong a lot. I would love for it to change. So is that okay if I read the introduction?
Absolutely.
All right. So it's a little bit. All right. Introduction. You feel so much, but you keep going. At the end of my 8-year participation in a group psychotherapy practice, I sat quietly, my eyes full of tears and heart full of gratitude, as my fellow therapist expressed their wishes for me as I expanded my private practice to a full-time endeavor. The practice, a healing oasis nestled above the busy streets of Madison Avenue in Midtown Manhattan, New York City, had a lovely ritual of giving departing members verbal and written messages of love and support as they moved on to the next phase of their lives. Though I had known for quite a while I needed to expand my own existing private practice, I was absolutely terrified to go out on my own. With the love and support of my irreplaceable mentor, Mary, and in hindsight, the gift of hotel construction next to my office, I finally decided to leave my nest. The unrelenting jackhammers were the universe's way of letting me know it was time. As we moved to the goodbye ritual and reflections, one of my colleagues said, "You feel so much, but you keep going." I noticed my body flinch and tense, my face tighten, and a feeling of anger rising in my chest. I feel so much and keep going. I do believe this fellow therapist's comment was meant as a compliment. It left me feeling a wee bit defensive and also confused. Was there something wrong with how much I feel and experience? Was it a surprise that I could feel so much and still function? Was I supposed to collapse if I expressed sadness, anger, or anxiety? What did my immediate feeling of anger mean? Why was I so conditioned to defend myself when someone brought up my sensitivity? I had identified as a highly sensitive person for several years and had even been given an opportunity to do training about highly sensitive people at my practice. I wondered if that training conveyed the true nature of the highly sensitive person. After I sat with my momentary irritation and anger, I realized how sensitivity can be so misunderstood and how it was part of my mission and calling as a therapist to assist other highly sensitive people to identify their strengths, work through their personal traumas and challenges, and let their positive traits shine. My colleague was right. I can feel so much and I can keep going. You, my dear highly sensitive human, can too. The training I provided did not convey the full strength and power of highly sensitive people and all the gifts we can bring to this world. I know my strength now more than ever, because as I write this, the world is currently moving through the COVID-19 pandemic. This is about March 13th, 14th, 2020. I am feeling so much and I am still going. I am holding my own fear, sadness, and grief, and holding space for my loved ones and my dear clients. I felt the anxiety in the air before the crisis began to crystallize. I felt the rush of panic as I had to leave my office and establish my practice online. I felt the sadness in my neighbor's eyes as we crossed paths on the way to wherever we would take refuge for an undetermined amount of time. I imagine you relating to these emotions as you read these words. We feel it all, and we keep going. The goal of this book and my clinical work is not only to provide education strategies, resources, but to simply teach you, empower you, and invite you to be yourself. All of you. You don't need to be molded, cured, or fixed. I can assure you there's nothing wrong with you. In fact, everything, and I truly mean everything, you need to live your authentic life is within you. You're very welcome, Sharon. So that's the intro. The theme of my work and the book. So let me pause. And again, I just said a lot.
The thing is that when you said you got this compliment, you feel so much, mm-hmm. you still keep going.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what I was thinking of is my own experience with grief and holding space for individuals.
Yes. Yes.
Who are, God, you're so strong. You just keep going in spite of what's happened. And, you know, you think of, well, what choice do I have? But the other part of it isn't about strength. It's about survival.
Yes. And you have to, right? And you just kind of scrape the bottom of the energy well and you keep going. Exactly. Yes. This is so alongside how people feel about grief. Absolutely. I notice this so much.
Yeah. And the other issue that I always have had I've dealt with a lot of artists that where I teach at Pratt Munson, Utica, who are very, very neurodivergent. but they're also very intuitive and multidimensional. They're also very highly sensitive.
Yes. Yes.
The thing that aggravates me is that as a therapist myself, another therapist would look at their the way they relate to the world as pathological. Let's put them on a, medication. Now, we've talked, we have talked, and we do, and we, you know, you've mentioned that there are individuals who are highly sensitive persons who are neurodivergent, AHD, and other types of neurodivergent tendencies, but not everybody is. But you can't label them with a diagnosis such as generalized anxiety, schizophrenia. What you're doing is poorly targeted treatment. But the second thing, you're medicating those qualities that make them who they are. And that's the issue that, that's the issue that I have had with individuals who have been misdiagnosed.
Absolutely. Well, that it's the pathology of the strong feelings must equal something that we have to pathologize or look at negatively, where a lot of HSPs, we're processing this, and it's how we get to a place of regulation. And also, it's just part of our humanity. And there's so much of that. I mean, the DSM is full of pathologizing, you know, normal human behavior. So absolutely. And so much with grief as well. There's an idea that like, oh, you're grieving. Oh, we got to stop that. We have to curb it. We need to distill it somehow. And no, that's not how you really move through grief. Absolutely.
Or the DSM-5 has this the 2-week benchmark that if you're still experiencing the symptoms of grief after 2 weeks, then we have to go to a major depression diagnosis.
Yes.
It's crap.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's complete crap. And before we started, I told you I was going to share something that actually personally happened to me with a professional that I was working with, where again, this exact topic came up about grief, actually. So it's so interesting that you bring that up. So is it okay if I go into that part?
Absolutely.
I had to advocate for myself in this, and the advocating process is still happening. I had been working with another mental health professional, an individual therapist. This is different from my psychiatrist that I'm going to bring up later. I had been working with this therapist for a few years for basically complex grief is the best way I can describe it. It was the grief that I encountered during the pandemic. I had many losses of people, places, my career, the way I thought it was going to go. I basically had described to someone the other day, like I had my life on a shelf and I felt like a big hand just wiped it clean. And I sort of had slowly put it back together or dealing with a lot of helplessness and waiting for other people to kind of put it back together. And so this is what I was seeing this individual for a number of years. And I came to session ready to talk about what I was going to talk about. And she, I don't know what happened to her, but it became very unsafe for me. I had to terminate working with her. And it was basically a form of therapeutic betrayal. That's the best way I can describe it. It was done in a way that, as a therapist too, it's kind of like if you were a surgeon and you knew you were being operated on and someone was being uncompassionate and just frankly sloppy and cruel, like you would notice that. And I think that's why also it was really traumatic for me. And so after it happened, I was so deeply in grief. I was so sad. I was enraged. I was confused. I was all of those things. But unlike other losses I had, there was some things I could do to advocate for myself. I could make reports. I could talk. I got support. I went to support groups. I contacted a few legal organizations. So I did all of these things, right? And so I also, in that time, write my psychiatrist and say, hey, this is what happened. Don't refer out to this person. This is what happened to me. And our next appointment, I'll let you know about this, right? I didn't tell him about all the things I had done, but like, hey, this happened. Don't refer to this person. I thought that was enough. And this is the person I'd been seeing for at least a decade. I didn't realize that till after we had this little therapeutic rupture. And I'm like, this person's known me for a long time. This is kind of strange. So I finally arrived to the session with him and he's like, how are you? And I start with my grief and I tell him how sad I am, how I've had trouble sleeping, how I've felt really angry. I felt like deeper existential things as well. I had a loss of faith in the therapeutic process. I was shocked. I was confused. I was betrayed. All of those things the night I was sharing my grief with this person. And they had known vaguely what had happened. And the first words out of their mouth was, Allison, we must get you out of this victim mentality. And I was like, I was like, pardon me? Victim? I couldn't help it again. I got angry and I had a file next to me, the documentation and paperwork and stuff I was doing. And I was like, well, I am not a victim. I am sharing my grief with you. And I have been advocating for myself. And then I listed to him all the stuff I had done. And by the way, I don't know if you've ever had to do this, but advocating for yourself or reporting somebody is hard. Being in a place where you have to go and disclose to people what happened to you is difficult because you have to relive it over and over and over again. And as I was advocating and talking to people, also, I was afraid for other people this therapist was working with. I felt protective of them as well. It was really hard. And so for the first words out of my psychiatrist's mouth that had known me to say, you're being a victim, I was like, wait a second. I was like, that's not what's happening here. Why are you making the assumption that I'm a victim because I'm sharing my grief with you? This is what's happening. This is how I process. And, you know, they caught themselves and they apologized, but I couldn't help it. I was like, do you speak to your clients this way? I was like, are you making an assumption if someone's moving through grief, they're a victim? Didn't answer me yes or no, but he promised me he would take a look at it and look at himself. We repaired it, but it said, here we are again. A moment where I think this is a safe space to process my grief, and your immediate response is don't be a victim and to pathologize me. What is this? And then I thought about my intro, and this is kind of what happens, because I think people don't, as you said, when you're going through grief, people don't have the idea that you can sort of emotionally multitask. Mm. It's like the way you described it. It's like you're feeling whatever you're feeling that day, whatever's coming up for your own grief, but you got to go to work. And people have this idea that we can't do both at the same time, and highly sensitive people, we can do this. Or with grief, you're sort of like, you build this muscle, you're forced to do this. And it was shocking to me that my mental health professional that maybe 10 years my senior did not understand this. And so I had to again educate them about it, remind them they knew I was a highly sensitive person, they knew I wrote a book, but somehow that, I think the sort of conditioning around grief sort of led the way for that conversation. And I had to very strongly push back.
Well, there's this myth that grief is time limited. You have to push through a particular amount of, predetermined amount of time. And if you don't, then it becomes pathological. I mean, I tell my students in death, dying, and bereavement, the second year for many individuals worse than the first year, because the realness of the first year wears off and the reality of the second year sets in. If I'm being a victim sharing my grief, then I've been a victim for over 22 years since my daughter's transition to a new experience, because I share my grief story anywhere I go.
Yes.
It doesn't make me a victim. It just makes me empowered. No. And I'm sharing a story because I trust that you're going to hold that story with integrity and validate my feelings, or at least listen to it without categorizing it.
Yes.
Or the second thing, in my case, it's like I share my story now to help others. So, heck, if we're all being victims sharing our stories with grief or sharing our grief, then I will take that kind of victimization any day, because it isn't victimization, it's empowerment.
No.
And
exactly.
It's talking about something that is very much a real part of our lives.
Yes, exactly. So it's kind of like transmuting that energy into something else, into action or into sharing it with other people. And yes, it doesn't go away. It just turns into something else. We first have a loss that's very acute, and we're sort of in that acute loss period, and then it starts to manifest into another type of energy. And exactly, and it's just so, it just hurts my heart to hear that we have so much information out there, but people don't get this about grief, especially mental health professionals, or the idea that you can hold multiple complex emotional experiences at once and still function. It really grinds my gears,
Well, it would grind my gears too. And I think what this tends to do is, if you're an HSP and you want to talk about your experience, but you have been kind of like just dismissed as it, well, you know, you're just your imagination, or basically it's just anxiety, it makes it very difficult for that HSP to want to come forward. And if our trauma is not validated, and grief is trauma, let's put it this way, it's traumatic experience.
Yes.
If that isn't validated, I may not go to another therapist to talk to them about my grief because of the previous experience I had with the other therapist. So what that does is it makes, my grief becomes disenfranchised, at least with other mental health professionals, because of my past experience with how I was treated before.
And those hilarious. We got to learn.
Yeah, well,
you and I know.
I mean, this didn't happen to me personally. I'm just talking in terms of,
I see,
what could happen with other individuals who had the similar experience with you, or other HSPs. Mm-hmm. The way they look at the world isn't validated, or at least isn't attempted to be understood.
Yes, or even the expression of it, because HSPs, we tend to be deeply emotionally expressive. Because we have a large interior, a lot of times I've had so many HSPs tell me how important words are to them, and how when they choose their words and how they express themselves. And so when they're talking about their pain, they might, to someone that might not understand it, be like, what's going on with you? And it's just, no, I'm just moving through it.
That's right. Now, you've mentioned, I think you alluded to earlier in the podcast, there's different types of HSPs. So can you give us an overview in terms of the types of HSPs there are, the factors that contribute to how HSPs manifest, how that manifests differently in people?
There's a couple different versions, and the different types is not based on my research. It's based on the research of Dabrowski, and they talk about neurodivergence. They kind of called it overexcitabilities. And so he and some of his researchers identified a few different types that I'm not going to go into too much, because actually, as I've worked with HSPs, I find that people are more of a mix of these things and not one or the other. But I think that the research was done in the guise of let's label everything. But I'm going to name them, and then I'm going to talk about actually the big division I see between HSP types. In terms of the Dabrowski sort of research, there are five types. They're emotional, imaginational, intellectual, psychomotor, meaning like in the body, somatic, and sensual. And so basically these different types talk about what sort of is highlighting for the HSP. So the emotional one might be really tuned into the emotions. The intellectual one might be more focused on more cerebral things. A psychomotor one would be very sensitive in terms of the body. They might also be like a gifted athlete. They might also be really gifted with their hands, things like that. What I tend to see is intersections. I find that HSPs are multi-talented. They're usually not just good at one thing. They're good at several different things. The big split I see between HSPs are ones that are considered, what is it called? My brain. High sensory seeking. So basically, high sensation seeking HSPs versus non-high sensation seeking HSPs. So I would be a high sensation seeking HSP. I live in New York City. I do like to be, in an environment that has a lot of energy, that has a lot of movement. I also, when I used to do theater, I used to do improv before I moved to New York. And I liked that little rush before I would get on stage. And so we tend to be HSPs that we do need the downtime, and we do need quiet, and we do have those deep interior lives, but we also like to have sort of high level exciting experiences as well, because it kind of gives that sort of kind of yummy flow state that we can get into. So like a lot of, I think, like actors and musicians, I'm lucky to work with a few folks that work on Broadway. They are a lot of high sensation seeking HSPs because they're, deep in their art, but they're also in a very high pressured environment. And I wanted to highlight them because generally when people hear about HSPs or they're in the media, it tends to be presented as someone that's more on the introverted side, quiet side, things like that. And so there's another group of us that really like to be out in a lot of energy and intense things, but we also need rest, and we also have a deep interior life. So those are the big differences that I see.
Yeah, and I didn't realize there were different types of HSPs until I think we had talked about that. But like you said, not one size fits all. They can be a combination of different types. Mm-hmm. Depending on the person, they can focus on the intellectual content. They can focus on the sensation-seeking content. Mm-hmm. So again, I think it's a good guideline to kind of show that delineation. But I think like with any categories, we need to realize that it can be very fluid. It's just not finite.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, to be honest, I didn't know about them either until I started to do the research for the book. And my editor is the one that's like, oh, do you know about these? And I was like, I don't. And then I started to, because it's not part of some of the, like, the core research that Elaine Aron puts out. It's sort of been talked about before a lot of the main research came out. And so that's why I didn't really know about it to start with. So it was new to me too when I first read about it and wrote about it. I see it in my practice, but honestly, it's usually more of a mix.
Speaking of your book,
beautiful,
the highly sensitive person's toolkit. So the highly sensitive person's toolkit, everyday strategies for thriving in an overstimulating world. What inspired you to write it, and what do you want readers to take away from it?
Actually, can I say something too about the title? So I was going to go back in time and change it, I would take out the word thriving in this point in time. I want to give people permission to not be thriving right now. I want them to give them permission to be like doing good, doing great, doing okay. But the idea of thriving, a little tough. We're tired.
Yeah. But maybe something like everyday strategies for just being.
For just being, for being yourself, your whole self. We don't necessarily have to thrive. Like it sounded good when it came out. The way the book happened is I was just going along my way, specializing in HSPs, working in the city. And the publisher, they've unfortunately, I think they don't fully exist anymore. They got bought out, but they came to me. And so the publisher named them Polito. They were looking for authors that were specializing in different topics. Then they said, hey, we've got this book idea. Could you give us a writing sample and kind of see if we can develop something with you? And so that's how that happened. I actually did not write the book until the publisher came to me. And then, you know, they gave me some ideas. I gave them a sample. And then I actually started to write it. I was still running my private practice full time. And I was spending all my nights and weekends writing. And then the pandemic happened. And so that's why the intro was written the way that it is, because I'm in the middle of writing it. And then I finished it and edited it. And, you know, it wasn't just me. And then it came out in 2020. So that was the process. And let me pause for a second.
Just tell our audience about the book.
Okay, cool. And so the book is, I think it kind of has like a little evergreen quality to it, and it's kind of turquoise, but it's basically a guide for being a highly sensitive person. And so it's full of education. The first part of it is just sort of learning about HSPs, a little bit of the academic research that's out there. And then I go into what I call the core sensitive skills, and then those skills, and we can go into that further if you like, but those are sort of foundation for other parts of the book. So I talk about being an HSP at work, in social situations, in friendships. I also talk about being, an HSP and having a relationship to our own spirituality, to the bigger world, also just how to manage our sensitive nervous systems, how to honor them, and just sort of how to be with ourselves, learn about ourselves in a kind, compassionate sort of, I use the analogy of sort of being our own understanding, compassionate parent and being there for ourselves.
I've gone through your book. It's just full of just great information, great research, great background on what HSPs are. For the novice who does not know who a highly sensitive person is and how they operate, this is very comprehensive, very, very comprehensive book. You mentioned core skills and competencies. What are the core skills and competencies that you believe are important for HSPs to simply be in the world?
Yes. So there are 9 of them, and I'm just going to go through them. So the first one, and this is the most important one, the one that I say is the foundation, difficult to practice. I don't want to say it's easy to do it, but it, again, it lays the foundation. And so that one, I call it self-advocating, self-parenting. And so it is being the advocate for ourselves, being the parent for ourselves. Like when I had that experience where I had to report the other person I was working with, I was very much in my own advocate mode. I remember thinking to myself, like, advocate girl, go, like, you practice what you preach. Don't, you know what I mean? And I was sort of, again, also holding my own hand as I was going through it, because I was advocating, but it was difficult, and sort of being my own parent in that way. And so the second one is called developing awareness of overstimulation. Again, super important. Because as highly sensitive people, we take in and absorb more sensory information. We are far more likely to become overstimulated, which I have learned as an HSP can really color an experience. Also can kind of distort sometimes what's actually happening. And it might just mean I need to go and regulate my nervous system. So like I've had experiences where I've been at a family function and the lights are really loud and the people are really loud and the food is smelling this and it's too hot. That's always one for me. It's too hot. I don't like what I'm wearing. Ugh. And then my brain might start going, oh, I don't like these people. I don't want to be here. I got to go. And it's just when you sit thinking these things. And what actually might be happening is, which I figured out is, I'm just overstimulated. I just need a moment to go off by myself, to regulate, to breathe, to get some water, tend to my body, open a window to maybe get something I want to eat, to be able to help regulate myself and get myself back to my higher mind, the logical part of the brain. So that's a really big one. Awareness, learning our preferences. What environments do we want to be in? What people do we want to be around? So that's a big one. The next one is developing awareness of a regulated and calm nervous system. Because generally it's human. We're good at knowing when we're anxious or when we're angry. We're not good at being aware when we're calm and regulated and what that feels like. And so getting familiar, and I kind of detail this in the book about how to identify what your calm, regulated nervous system feels like, because it also teaches the brain that that is also a thing that we experience. If we've gone through trauma, we can occasionally get stuck in chronic states of anger, anxiety, or things like that. We don't notice sometimes when we are calm. So it's good to pay attention to. The next one you mentioned earlier, which is around self-soothing, or I kind of call it working with our self-cleaning oven, because the body, as we know, through the work of Peter Levine, if we can get our bodies into a particular environment, we give it certain cues like deep breathing, grounding, being able to self-soothe and recognize when we need to self-soothe and work with it and trust that if I can do a few things to help ground myself, my body actually knows what to do. Right. The next one, the fifth one, is developing awareness of emotion, naming, allowing, and processing feelings. Huge for HSPs, because we are taught, usually in our childhoods, in our environments, not to know our emotions, know what they feel like, how to name them, how to honor them, how to process them, like grief, right? And so being aware of those and honoring them, not pathologizing them. The next one is honoring, responding to truth and justice. And I wanted to add a little bit, the how and why and to what degree. So right now we're living in a time where there is a lot of untruths and a lot of unjust things going on. And for HSPs, we tend to care deeply about things that are going on in the world. Also, there might be untruths and injustice also in our lives, in our family systems. And so how to really honor that and how to help work with that within us. However, and that looks different for everybody. So that came up a lot during certain social movements, like during 2020. And I had a lot of HSPs going, I want to respond, but I don't know if going to a march and marching for 4 hours feels like the right choice for me. And so finding a path for them, how to be effective and speak their truth, but also honor their nervous system at the same time. The next one, one of my favorites that doesn't get talked about enough, I feel like, is the honoring and developing joy and creativity. Again, it's important to feed our joy, to be intentionally joyful. That's something that I almost assign to clients sometime. Like I assign you to go have a good time because that is helpful to you as meditating or doing therapy stuff or reading books, just having fun. Also creativity, I find really connected to joy. And that's also a big place where HSPs can replenish because a lot of times when we're going through trauma or going through a tough experience, our creativity might be pushed on the back burner or something we might not honor. And it really needs to be sort of a part of us. The next one, again, this is easy to talk about, hard to practice. Setting and tolerating boundaries. Meaning, when you set a boundary, it's there. But as you probably know, when you set a boundary, you also have to tolerate that it's there because you might want to push on it. The person you're setting the boundary with might want to push on it. Boundaries can be hard to maintain sometimes. And so kind of tolerating that a boundary has been set. The last one, and this can be kind of used in many different ways, but reframing difficult situations. And so sometimes we find ourselves in difficult situations. And so in the book, I use an example, being trapped in a sensory situation that you can't get out of. So getting on a subway car and there's a smell somewhere. And I've never had this experience on the subway, but sometimes you're on this train and it's busy and you're trapped and you can't move and you're hot and you're sweating and there's a smell. And the best maybe you can do is maybe stick your nose, and I'm like picturing stick your nose and maybe your throat to kind of like block the smell. And even that doesn't help, right? And so it's like for an HSP, this is really like, it really grates on the nervous system. And so sometimes it's just more fun to reframe. So I'll make a game out of it. I'll play, what's that smell? And so I'll spend the time imagining what's that smell. And I'll imagine we're on a game show and I got to figure it out. And somehow that imaginational work and being in my head for a moment and playing some imaginary game in my mind. So I take the half hour train to Grand Central, get off and take a full breath. Then I can make it. But you can reframe difficult situations in different ways. But I find for sensory things, it's another tool we can use. So yeah, those are the 9 core sensitive skills. So any thoughts, questions about?
I was smiling when you said to sign your HSP clients to go out and have a good time. I remember one intervention that my supervisor and mentor did when I was working at the McPike Addiction Treatment Center. There was a person who was just so afraid of making a mistake because of the, what making mistakes in childhood, the implications for that were. If he made a mistake, he got abused. So he learned that he had to be perfect to avoid getting abused.
Yes.
So my supervisor gave him an assignment. He said, your job is I want you to get written up for a minor rules violation in the supervisor's log. And then we'll talk about it after. And he wanted to do that so he could process with him what it was like to not be perfect. And that, you know, it was okay not to be. You made a mistake and mistakes are information. So
yeah. Well, me and the supervisor must have been on the same wavelength. So there's a little portion of my book where I call it intentional mistake making. Yep. It's like a practice. So it can be like I do really low stake stuff, like go to a restaurant, intentionally order the wrong thing, and then go back and correct it. Because the key to that is because, like you said, in childhood, it's so distressing and really it's part of our protection to not make a mistake, right? As adults, it's going to happen. Also, we're humans. And so being able to tolerate that distress of making the mistake and also teaching the brain that it's going to be okay. It's not always going to be this traumatic experience the way it was as a child. Yeah. But when it's trauma, it gets locked in that sort of black and white type of story.
Yeah. And I think the other thing with a lot of the core competencies that you teach, I think some of them teach HSPs to lighten up a little bit and to try to have fun, because what they carry, they're not only carrying the energy of their own traumas, they're carrying the energies of everybody else's trauma that they come into contact with. And in context, they're carrying the world's trauma, especially when you look at COVID, you look at other types of movements that impact, that impact the human race. They're going to carry all of that. And I think to try to help them lighten their load by just learning to have a little fun, not taking themselves as seriously at times. That may, I think that helps them, that may help secure some balance in their lives too.
Yeah. Well, I'd shift the language a little bit. I wouldn't tell them to lighten up. That's kind of like, you know, that experience. Again, I'm very sensitive to language, but maybe we need to reorganize.
Yes.
Maybe we need to reprioritize sort of what is, reprioritize your empathy in terms of what you would like to maybe lead with or what more energy we want to give to versus what maybe deserves a little bit less. Because part of being, I think, neurodivergent is we can't actually change the wiring that much. Like you can heal from trauma, but to try to change someone's deep feelings, not really. But can we reorganize and reprioritize? Absolutely, we can.
And I like that too, because I've learned in grief to be very mindful of my language in terms of how I phrase things, because if I phrase something not knowing where that person is in their grief journey, that can cause more harm than good. So now, that's a good reminder for me if I'm working with somebody who's highly sensitive, is to be mindful of my language too. And also to be open to the fact that if my language is not really helping them understand their situation, or they find it hurtful, or they don't understand it, is to question me with it so we come to an understanding. So
Yeah. And it's something we learn along the way. It's like we try to have an open dialogue with our clients. But yeah, sometimes we're not quite sure how something's going to land until a client might tell us.
Yeah. And like the mantra of this podcast, it reflects how I do things in real life. We're all students and teachers. So let's learn from each other. Let's create that collaborative classroom. Whether it's in the counselor's office, the clinician's office, or in the classroom. So,
yes, we're always practicing.
Yes, and we are coming close to the end of our time. I could talk.
Oh, that went so fast.
I know. I could talk to you for about another hour or so. But my last question for you is, if my audience wants to get in touch with you, contract for your services, purchase your book, what's the best way for them to do that, Allison?
Yeah, so the book is available, I think, pretty much anywhere online. It's on Amazon. You can find it at any major booksellers. If you want to reach out to me, my website is almft.com. Just to note, it's in dire need of a makeover, and it's going to get it. It's just, I'm a tired therapist, but yes, it needs a makeover. But it is on there. Also, you can email me. My email is on the website, and I'll say it just here. It's just my name. Allison Lefkowitz at iCloud.com. And either my website or my email are the easiest, quickest way to contact me.
Perfect. Then I will make sure all of your contact information gets entered in the episode notes when our podcast goes live on YouTube and my other podcast platforms. Allison, thank you so much. This is a great conversation today.
Oh, you're so welcome. This is so fun.
Yeah, it's great. And I am so glad Suzanne connected us. And again, my final shout out to Suzanne as well, too, for the connection. Yes. And I hope you have a wonderful holiday season. Bless 2026. And I'm sure we will be in touch soon.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Thank you, Allison. And with that, that's a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.